welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will be back tomorrow. This is your call. CRISPR, the powerful gene editing technique that enables the precise modification of genes, promises to revolutionize medicine and biotechnology, and to give us the ability to directly edit DNA in embryos, perhaps treating cancer and other life-threatening diseases, and allowing us to more broadly predict future risks to our health. But the ability to edit the genome has sparked a debate about the ethics and limits of human genetic engineering, the prohibitively high cost of emerging treatments, and who will benefit from these breakthroughs. On today's Your Call, we'll look at the emerging applications of genomic medicine and their implications. When should gene editing be used? Who will control it? And how can we make sure its benefits are widely distributed? To explore this issue with us in the hour, we're joined by Dr. Marcy Darnofsky, Executive Director of the Berkeley-based Center for Genetics and Society, which encourages responsible uses and effective governance of human genetic and assisted reproductive technologies. She's written widely on the politics of human biotechnology, focusing on their implications for social justice and the public interest. Dr. Darnofsky, great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Also on the line is Dr. Samuel Sternberg. He is a protein RNA biochemist and CRISPR expert. He's the co-author, along with Jennifer Doudna, of A Crack in Creation, which is a book about the discovery, development, and applications of CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing technology. And I should also say that he is a scientist and group leader at Caribou Biosciences, which is a biotech startup that develops genomic engineering technology, and he's going to start his own lab at Columbia next year. Sam, great to have you with us.
Great to be here. Good morning.
Excellent. So let's just start, because many people have heard about CRISPR, but I think that it's worth just breaking down what the technology is and how it works and why it is such a breakthrough, why so many people are interested, excited, concerned about it. Dr. Sternberg, this is your life work. Talk about how it actually works.
Sure. Well, CRISPR is actually discovered in bacteria. In nature, it exists as an immune system that allows bacteria to defend themselves against viruses. But it turns out that you can harness some of the molecular components that work basically like a pair of molecular scissors, a precision-guided pair of molecular scissors that allow you to go into the genome to sift through the billions of letters of DNA in the genome and make targeted changes at specific locations. And it's not the first gene editing technology, but it's by far the most flexible and the most facile to use. And so it's given researchers a completely new way to make designer changes in model organisms and in cells and really understand biology and think about treating disease in a new way.
And so talk about what are some of the initial applications that are coming forward for this technology? What are some of the first areas where people are trying to put it to use?
Well, I'll tell you, in the research laboratory, where I work now, and go to any university in the world, and a research lab studying biology will probably be using CRISPR, and which is, I think, a remarkable trend, given that this tool was really only invented about 5 years ago, and it's just seen remarkable spread through the research community. And so, as a research tool, we have a powerful new way to really interrogate biology by using this ability to rewrite DNA and then understand the consequences of those changes. And then I think, one of the most exciting areas of application is to really harness that capability to potentially target and treat disease at the level of DNA. And so, taking a common genetic disease like sickle cell disease or cystic fibrosis, we could imagine using CRISPR to actually rewrite the genetic code and correct the mutation to kind of nip the disease at its source so that the mutation no longer exists in the cells in the patient. But I think the applications are incredibly diverse. They go into agriculture, potentially into ecological engineering. So I think, any organism has DNA as its code, and being able to rewrite that code is incredibly powerful.
So, Marcy Darnofsky, when you're watching actually like what's coming, what are coming to clinical trials, what's actually, what are the things that like you say, like, oh, this is actually going to be not just something that's happening at research labs, but that's actually going to be being used. What are the things you're watching most closely in your work and that you're most interested in seeing? How are these going to be used and how are they going to be regulated?
Well, our work focuses on the human applications of gene editing and other genetic modification technologies. So we as many people, tend to divide those into two big categories. The one is what Sam has been talking about, using CRISPR and gene editing to treat and hopefully improve the outcomes for people that, for patients that have disease. So that would be using gene editing on body cells, non-reproductive cells or somatic cells. And, you know, that's a really exciting prospect, and I think it's widely supported. I think we have to be careful there not to jump the gun, to think that it's all the problems are going to be solved by Christmas. That's not going to be the case. And I think we also have to really think hard about the prices that we're seeing attached to some of the emerging CRISPR treatments that are coming out of clinical trials now. So those are really important questions, but they're kind of familiar social and ethical questions. There's a different category of using gene editing, and that I think poses really very unfamiliar, maybe unprecedented questions for us. And that's the use of gene editing to alter the genes and therefore the traits of future children, and those changes would be reflected then in all subsequent generations. So those changes would be made to reproductive cells. They would be inheritable. And that opens up a whole can of worms that we really need to think about in terms of what kind of world do we want to build.
For those of us whose human biology is many decades in the past, when you talk about the reproductive cells, where is that happening? How would these interventions occur?
So that kind of heritable gene editing would be accomplished by modifying or engineering the genes in sperm, in eggs, or in early human embryos. And if a pregnancy was initiated with an altered embryo or one made with altered sperm or eggs, then the child that if the child did develop appropriately, that child would be born with changed DNA in every cell of its body.
So Sam Sternberg, among the people you work with, obviously, Sam, like every lab on Earth is working on these kind of questions. Do you make that same distinction and think differently about those different kind of uses of CRISPR?
Yeah, I mean, I think Marcy absolutely defined that distinction. I would just qualify what you said. You know, I think there are very few labs actually that are working on CRISPR in the context of human reproduction. Now, it's significant to note that there have been some published articles that have experimented with the use of CRISPR in human embryos, but I do think this is a very small slice of the research community, albeit one that must be, you know, addressed and recognized. I think this is a growing issue, and Marcy's been one of the leading voices in bringing this to light. But I think, you know, for the most part, researchers, companies, I mean, people interested in commercializing this technology are really going after, you know, disease cures and ways of really harnessing this to improve people's lives who are alive today.
I actually want to talk for a minute about that question of kind of, you know, this kind of complex of people who do the research and bring it to market, and just kind of how actually this science got done and how this kind of medical science is being done today. I mean, I know a lot of people will have heard about the battle over the patent for CRISPR technology, you know, between MIT and Harvard, a center there, and of course, the center at UC Berkeley, headed up by your colleague Jennifer Doudna. And so, you know, we're going to get into the questions of ownership, what that means for the cost and availability of these kind of therapies. But just talk a little bit. I mean, you work in this lab. How do these discoveries get made, you know, and who's supporting that work, and how, once those breakthroughs are made, what happens next? I mean, you've been on both parts of this, Dr. Sternberg.
Yeah, you know, I think CRISPR is such an amazing breakthrough story because it really only came about through very fundamental research into an area of science that I think on its surface would have seemed to have no relevance to human health or really biotechnology at all. You know, about 5-10 years ago, there were maybe a few dozen researchers, tops in the world, who were studying CRISPR. I can remember going to my first conferences as a graduate student, and even in the world of RNA biochemistry, people had barely heard of CRISPR, and now, you know, it couldn't be more different today. So I think that's really a testament to the need to support basic research moving forward. And this is something that, you know, I talk about a lot with my colleagues, and, you know, as we think about how science gets supported at the federal level with funding for the National Institutes of Health, I think you couldn't have a better example than CRISPR for why we need to continue supporting this kind of fundamental research.
Go ahead.
So, you know, Jennifer's lab, we were studying bacteria. We wanted to understand how these enzymes work that are involved in this immune system. And that was really how this key breakthrough came about, you know, this Cas9 enzyme that could be repurposed for gene editing.
So I guess the question, so you're talking about the federal support for this basic research, you know, and and obviously it takes a big investment, and no one knows whether a technology like CRISPR, when it's, like you say, a few scientists are working on it, whether or not that's going to come to fruition. But then we had this process, you know, earlier this year, the U.S. Patent Board said that this, you know, this group at MIT and Harvard, that they were the ones who, at least for the time being, and I understand there's an ongoing court battle over this, but that, you know, that they had the basic rights to this, and that now, you know, their corporate spinoff, which is called Editas Medicine, is licensing the use of this technology. Dr. Darnovsky, I just kind of ask you, this process of the support that comes, you know, these kind of usually university-based research that then ends up, you know, being commercialized, often with the researchers on both sides of that process, you know, just to kind of explain what it means that now they're able to license this technology. Does that give them some kind of control over when and how it's going to be used? And does every other scientist have to pay them a fee to do so?
Well, that is what patenting means.
Yeah.
And I would say that when Sam described the importance of basic research, I would agree with him 100% that we have to continue as a society to put public funds into basic research. But right now, that's only half the story. A generation ago, scientists that were working in the university laboratory would never have thought really to invest and become principals of commercial companies and make a lot of money as founders or consultants or board members. It would be, you know, it was considered kind of in bad odor. But now it's completely different. Now you're a sucker if you're not doing that and you're a scientist. So we live in an era now where we have to figure out what it means to support with public money this basic research that could lead to really society-changing developments in technology, and yet a lot of the profits of that publicly funded research are going to go to private entities. That's a really fundamental problem we live with right now.
I guess, Sam,
it's not just CRISPR.
Yeah, when people hear about, you know, government-supported, societally supported fundamental research, and then hear, oh, well, then it basically goes into private hands, and for continuing research to happen, those private hands got to be paid. How do you think about that? You're someone, obviously, you live in this world. You're in this generation of scientists.
Yeah, well, as you commented, I'm going back to academia, so I'll be the poor academic, not the one making money at the company. But, you know, it's certainly not an area where I have any kind of expertise. One thing that I've gathered from working at Caribou and being a bit more privy to what it actually takes to develop technologies on a commercial level and you know, even starting to think about therapeutics at other companies, this requires a massive investment, an investment that, you know, no academic lab or even groups of academic labs could really do themselves. So I think there are large costs, and I guess, you know, the justification often given is that for making that investment, you need some kind of assurance that you're going to have an ability to generate revenue at the end of that long path. I do think it's an open question. You know, at the university level, I mean, should patents be aggressively sought? I know, you know, there are a couple loud voices in this area. Mike Eisen at UC Berkeley is one who's really been outspoken against the current model for patenting. You know, one thing that gives me relief is, you know, for academics, I mean, CRISPR has been distributed globally by not-for-profit companies like Adgene, based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and there's really no hurdles in place at all for researchers to really experiment and develop and further improve these tools. And I think that's really important, is that you don't have licensing agreements that can prevent academic researchers from really pushing more in this direction.
That's the voice of Dr. Samuel Steinberg. He is a protein RNA biochemist and CRISPR expert, co-author along with Jennifer Doudna of A Crack in Creation, a book about the discovery and development of CRISPR gene editing technology. He's also with Caribou Biosciences and is going to set up his own lab at Columbia in the coming year. Also with us on today's Your Call is Dr. Marcy Darnofsky, executive director of the Berkeley-based Center for Genetics and Society. We are talking about CRISPR and gene editing, its uses, potential and current, and what its implications socially, economically, for equitable medicine in this country. Obviously, a lot of potential for treating disease and preventing disease, but also a lot of big questions. And we invite you to join the conversation. The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. If you are a medical researcher or someone who knows the biology, knows the chemistry, has been following this, may have your own questions, we'd love to have you join us. If you are someone who just simply cares about the potential treatments that might come down the pike or what it's going to mean for our healthcare system, we invite you to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. You can also email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who's going to be back tomorrow. But this is our subject today, and we would love to have you join the conversation. So I'm going back to you were talking, Marcy Darnofsky, about, you know, some very, when it comes to the human applications that are more about treatments, that there's, you know, longstanding social and ethical questions that, you know, are always around kind of new medical technologies. And one of them is simply that as these emerge, it looks like they're going to be, at least at the moment, going to be incredibly expensive. Tell us about what you're seeing and what you see as the kind of the long-term implications of some of these really high-end but potentially life-saving therapies, and what that means for how medicine gets done and who gets served.
Right. Well, one data point that I think is illustrative is that a recently approved treatment that involves the use of CRISPR for a very rare childhood leukemia has a price tag of $475,000, close to $500,000. And, you know, this we have to look at in the context of other extraordinarily high drug prices, in the context of the pharmaceutical industry's claim that they spend all this money in R&D and merely have to reclaim it, against the research of other scholars who say, wait a second, you don't need to make these very handsome and generous profit margins, that's not warranted. You're talking about people's lives. So the danger here is we're going to be developing a whole set of treatments that some people will be able to afford, and if they work, they will, you know, have remissions, maybe long ones, but then there will be another set of people who, unless they get funding through some novel method, which there are ways to explore that, they won't be able to have access to those treatments, and that replicates and exacerbates the kinds of health disparities that we see. And, you know, here's where I think we have to really broaden our view and not just look at a particular new treatment, as important as those are, but really look at our society, where some people just don't have access to basic health care, clean water, good food, and yet other people are going to be spending $500,000 on a treatment. We want all that for everybody when these are, you know, for these kinds of technologies, but in our society, we're a very long way from that. So it's something we have to pay attention to. And the commercial dynamics that we're seeing in the pricing of these treatments using CRISPR, I think we also have to think about in the context of what would happen if it were ever approved to use CRISPR on human embryos and create children who are genetically modified human beings, essentially. I think what you could predict with pretty good confidence there is that once that's on the market, you would have biotech companies and fertility clinics marketing genetic upgrades for offspring of wealthy people, and you would have competitive pressures, commercial pressures, and I think you'd be off to a world where we'd have this new kind of inequality, this new kind of discrimination based on purported biological differences. I mean, even if the editing didn't really make those genetically modified children smarter, there would be the impression and the perception that they were. And we know how biological differences work in society today. It's one of the core springs of the terrible inequality and discrimination that we live with.
I want to get to those implications, particularly of that kind of stuff you're talking about, the, you know, what do people call designer babies or whatever you want to call that. But I do want to just stop for a minute on the question of the, you know, these therapies that are coming out that are so high priced, and the one you mentioned for childhood leukemia, I've seen some price tags higher than that for some of these individual therapies. Isn't part of that just that these are brand new? Isn't that part of the reason why they're so expensive, and we can expect they're going to get cheaper over time?
Well, that particular one and some of the others are for diseases that are very rare. So the companies are claiming that they have to keep the price that high in order to recoup their R&D investment. And there are challenges to those claims. And the companies themselves, in fact, are trying to figure out novel pricing schemes, because health insurers are just not going to cover that. So it's going to be really limited unless something is figured out. And it's going to really exacerbate disparities, social and health disparities, unless something is figured out.
Let's go to our first call. Oh, yeah, go ahead. Please, come on in, Sam. Yeah.
So, yeah, Matt, I think you bring up a great point. I mean, this drug, Kymriah, is one of the first treatments of its kind. I should clarify, it actually doesn't use any CRISPR or gene editing. It's slightly different. It's a cell-based therapy where a gene was inserted into the genome, but without the use of a nuclease like CRISPR-Cas9. That being said, I think there's a lot of hope for CRISPR to be paired with this growing area of cancer immunotherapy in the future. But yeah, in my opinion, I mean, you know, I think most medical breakthroughs start off with a heavy price tag, as with many breakthrough technologies, and over time they become more available and accessible. And I think there's a lot of hope that, you know, with this first treatment of this kind, where genetically modified cells are used as the treatment itself, as that becomes approved in this first case, and the manufacturing protocols and procedures for generating these kinds of cells becomes more mainstream, that I think the cost in future types of treatments like this should go down. I also think it's worth noting that a number of analysts have actually argued that Novartis's price for this drug is below what it actually costs to produce, and they're also exploring an outcomes-based pricing model where they actually only receive reimbursements for the treatment if patients have a positive response. So I think it's certainly an issue that we need to pay attention to, but, you know, I would argue this is not a zero-sum game. It's not either these high-priced new treatments or other kinds of treatments. I think we should innovate in all directions. And at the end of the day, I mean, if we have a new type of treatment that's going to cure cancer, we should absolutely pursue it and keep chipping away at it so that we can make those kinds of treatments even more common and less expensive in the future.
That's Dr. Sam Sternberg. He's a protein RNA biochemist, expert in CRISPR, co-author along with Jennifer Doudna of the book A Crack in Creation. Also with us in this hour is Dr. Marcy Darnofsky, executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society based in Berkeley. And we're talking about gene editing, particularly the CRISPR technology that has emerged in the last few years and is now really coming to fruition, and looking at its implications, what its costs are going to be, how it'll actually be applied for human health, and asking what it's going to mean for the delivery of healthcare. Who will benefit from this kind of technology, and who may not? And when we say who will benefit, who will actually get the treatments, and maybe also who will profit? And we want to ask about the basic science and also about how it's going to be put into place. And we invite you to join the conversation at 866-798-8255. We'll be taking your calls after this break coming up. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we will be right back.
Next time on 1A, Ta-Nehisi Coates. His new book reflects on the historic presidency of Barack Obama and how he says it led to the election of Donald Trump. Ta-Nehisi Coates on race, politics, white supremacy, and the White House. Next time on 1A.
1A coming up in a half hour here on 91.7 KALW. This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call, and we do podcast the program. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can find past shows if you want to listen again or share them with other people. On tomorrow's Your Call, we are going to be talking to the filmmakers behind a new documentary called Company Town, which is about people in a small Arkansas town who went up against Georgia Pacific, big paper and chemical company owned by the Koch brothers, over what they said was cancers caused by the paper mill in their town. So it's an environmental justice story, pretty important. You'll want to tune in for that tomorrow. And on Thursday, Rose is going to be talking about guns and the attack in Las Vegas. And we'll want to hear from you as well a couple days afterwards to think about where we are in our country around those issues. We are today, however, talking about gene editing technology, specifically CRISPR, which enables the precise modification of genes, which has medical and biotechnological implications. And we have a couple of great guests with us for the hour, Dr. Marcy Darnofsky from the Center for Genetics and Society, and Dr. Sam Sternberg, who's a protein RNA biochemist and CRISPR expert. And we are inviting you to join the conversation. If you are a researcher, someone in biology, chemistry, medicine, who knows about this work, or maybe you're a doctor or other healthcare professional who's interested in knowing what's coming down the line, or you're someone who's simply interested in what this technology might mean for you or for medicine and healthcare in our society, we invite you to join us, 866-798-TALK, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to go to a caller, William in Belvedere. Welcome to Your Call.
Yes, thank you very much. This is obviously a very complex subject, and I hope that the guest could explain it in simple terms. There are some changes that can be made that will affect the offspring of a mother and father, but just that offspring. Then there are changes that can be made that will be incorporated in the offspring's sperm or egg, and therefore will have an effect down the line to grandchildren, great-grandchildren, etc., etc. For instance, with, say, sickle cell anemia, you could make some kind of change that would affect that a particular child shouldn't have sickle cell anemia. You might be able to make some kind of change that would mean that even that the children of the children of the children would never again be afflicted with it. And I'd appreciate it if the guest could, as simply as possible, explain that distinction.
I think Marcy Darnofsky did a bit of that earlier in the program, but Sam Sternberg, would you also like to take a shot at this?
Sure. The key distinction comes down to when in development the individual has their cells edited and which kinds of cells are edited. So, for example, let's take a hypothetical that a father's sperm cells were edited in his body. Those sperm cells would then go on to fertilize an embryo, fertilize an egg cell leading to an embryo, and because those edited sperm cells are contributing half the chromosomes of the resulting individual, the individual would inherit whatever changes were made in the sperm. Similarly, if CRISPR were introduced into that fertilized egg cell at the one cell stage, let's say during the course of in vitro fertilization, then that embryo, that one cell embryo, would have the changes made so early in development that all cell divisions occurring thereafter during embryonic development, during the growth of the fetus in the womb, those changes would be copied into every cell. And so again, that individual, as well as that individual's future sperm or eggs, would all be edited. And so those changes would be heritable. Now, on the other hand, if let's say that baby were born with cystic fibrosis and some kind of gene editing treatment were administered to the lungs of the baby after birth, that could have a permanent effect on that child, on that baby, by editing its lung cells. But because that baby's sperm or eggs weren't edited, because that treatment was administered very locally, then its future offspring would not be edited. And so it really comes down to when in development and which kinds of cells are being edited. Cells of the body, like Marcy explained earlier, or germ cells like eggs and sperm, or early cells of the embryo that will become eggs and sperm.
Sam Sternberg, thanks for that explanation. William, does that do you think that breaks it down clearly enough?
What strikes me from what he said would be that I can't think why anyone would want to make the change at the later stage if they could make the change at the earlier stage and therefore have a much more sweeping effect. Is that what I'm saying clear?
Yeah. I mean, that's a very provocative and interesting point. And, you know, certainly if we had, you know, omniscience, you know, if we were omniscient and we had all knowledge of who will ever have a disease, then, of course, the earlier you can treat it or eradicate those mutations from the genome, obviously in a hypothetical sense, that would have a more lasting benefit to the health of the patient and future generations. That, of course, doesn't do anything for individuals living today with cystic fibrosis. And in many cases, unless parents are already turning towards in vitro fertilization, you know, future individuals will be born with disease that won't have been detected before their birth. And so that kind of removes any possibility of going into the germline and editing earlier in development because you don't have that prior knowledge. I don't know if Marcy wants to comment further there.
Yeah, I think, William, you're raising a really good point and one that needs to be clarified and often doesn't get clarified in these conversations. And that is that the what's held out as a justification for what's called germline or inheritable editing is that we can prevent the transmission of serious genetic diseases to future children and all of their offspring subsequently. But here's the thing. You don't need to use gene editing. You don't need to manipulate or muck around in your future child's genes in order to prevent the birth of children with these very serious conditions like Tay-Sachs or Huntington's disease. Where it's appropriate to do that, to avoid births of children that do have those conditions, we can use an already existing technique that's available in fertility clinics. That's an embryo selection technique. And you get all of the benefits of an unaffected child genetically related to both parents, but without the risks both to that child and to society of introducing the possibility of opening the door wide to inheritable changes. Now, it's true that embryo selection raises some of the same questions that gene editing itself would raise. And from a disability justice point of view, we have to think really hard. All of us have to think really hard about what traits are okay to edit out of the human population.
Yes, explain. I mean, I think I can imagine what some of those risks would be or concerns would be. But why wouldn't you say if there's, you know, here's this thing in someone's genetics, they're like, this, you know, means, you know, X percentage chance of some really awful disease being passed down through generations, where, you know, may or may not have the means to go in and do that embryonic selection. Why wouldn't you want to take that out?
Why would you not want to use gene editing?
Yeah, it's something that would go down the germline.
Well, here's the thing. We are still at a very, very early stage of our knowledge about human genetics. And if we do change one gene, we don't know in almost all cases what other effects might ensue. And a cascade during early development. And as the child, you know, develops, is born, and grows into an adult, and future generations. So safety is the first reason. The non-necessity is the second reason, that to avoid transmitting inherited disease, you don't have to use gene editing. You have this other selection possibility. And then the third reason, which is the one that, you know, I really lose sleep over, is the idea that were we to permit, and most countries in the world have looked at this question and said, you know, yes, let's use genetic modification to help people who are sick, but let's make it a no-go zone for inheritable changes. More than 40 countries have passed those laws, and one of the key reasons...
And the United States is not one of them, right?
The United States is not, although we do have some soft law, agency regulations and the like that we can talk about, but the concern is that we would be opening the door to wealthy people who could regularly afford these techniques, and they're always going to be fairly expensive, engineering children who are said to be biologically superior. And we have a long history of racism based on purported biological differences between groups. We have a long and ugly history of eugenics in this country as well as in Germany, that was exactly focused on eliminating people who were thought to not deserve to live. So we, I think, have to be extraordinarily careful in opening the door to a new version of eugenics that could come out of inheritable gene editing. And if we keep that door closed, I think it helps people support the very worthy goals of using gene editing for treating patients.
William, I want to thank you for that question. Obviously, really fruitful for our understanding of CRISPR and these other gene editing technologies. If you'd like to join the program, you have just basic questions about how this stuff works or what it might mean. The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Whether this is stuff that you know from your own work or whether it's something you've just read about or you're hearing about for the first time and you have questions or comments, we appreciate you joining the program. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Sam Sternberg, do any of those questions keep you awake at night?
Yeah, I think, Marcy, you brought up a lot of great points there. And, you know, I think for me, the access issue is one that leaves me with greatest pause, which is, you know, not true of the specter of germline editing, but many other health science treatments as well. You know, I will say, one of the first things she mentioned, I mean, I think there are obvious questions about safety with gene editing that are being very actively studied, not in the case of germ cells, but just in any kinds of application. You know, I don't see actually a clear distinction between selecting embryos that are free of a particular mutation versus removing that mutation with gene editing. I think, you know, she brought up this question of what would be the cascade of implications of that change, but in fact, if we're selecting for certain genetic variants through embryo selection, then there should be no additional health concerns if we're introducing the same exact change through gene editing if we have a situation where both parents happen to have the mutated version of the gene. So, you know, I think in terms of safety, if the issue of the accuracy of gene editing can be proven, then I don't see that categorical distinction really prohibiting the potential use in that direction. But I think absolutely, I mean, cost, access, social justice, these are all issues that I grapple with and that Jennifer and I wrote about quite extensively in the book. One quick note, Matt, by the way, Jennifer's last name is pronounced Doudna, not Doudna.
Oh, there I go. I mean, we always check our guests, but this is my problem when I don't check my guest colleagues for their pronunciation. Thank you so much for the correction. I really appreciate
it.
And Marcia Darnofsky, so just respond to Sam Sternberg, his question there about, you know, why should we draw this distinction between those two therapies? In your mind, obviously, you draw some kind of distinction there.
Very much. On the safety dimension, I think that we're not there yet, and who knows if we will get there to be able to say that we can edit embryos with the kind of precision that you would have to be a prerequisite to any attempt to create a new human being. I mean, it's a really categorically different kind of thing to treat a person who's sick and to create a new person. And yeah, I think there's an argument that using CRISPR in that inheritable way, it shouldn't really even be considered a medical technology.
Well, I think he was saying the distinction between the embryonic selection versus the gene editing.
Yes, so you'd have to assume that the gene editing could be done with great precision, with no off-target effects immediately or later, with no problems of different cells being changed, but some cells not being changed. So the safety issues are still enormous, and I think that's, you know, I think what Sam was saying is if those could be addressed, then would there be this safety distinction between selection and modification? And I think it's a very big if. But there's another point I think that needs to be made, that which is that when you're using embryo selection, you have a finite number of embryos from which to choose. It's in the fertility clinic, it's in vitro fertilization, the way that diseases are inherited in many cases when there's a single gene mutation means that half of the embryos on average will be free of the mutation that is associated with a disease. So you would choose from among a small number. when you're talking about modification, editing, you're talking about making changes as many as you want. And, you know, there's not that kind of finite number that keeps the social justice consequences within some bounds.
Let's go to our next caller, Maury in San Francisco. Welcome to your call.
Oh, hello. Yes, I'm just picking up on, I know it's not the science of this issue. One minute, come on. You know, this privatization and of the benefits of a public investment really bother me. Why do we, as taxpayers, not have the same relationship that private investors in private companies have? So in a private company, you buy stock, you get a dividend, and you benefit. In the public, when we finance things like this, we get no benefit. And the costs are socialized, and the benefits are privatized. So my thought is, why do we not have a system where when the taxpayer puts up money for scientific research like this, there isn't a contract with the private the private exploiter of it to finance people who can't afford it out of the dividend that we get back?
That's a great question, Maury. I'd love to get Sam Sternberg to respond to that. Is there a way that, you know, basically as kind of a return for the public investment, there should be something that comes back to the public sector from the private development?
Yeah, I think those are great points. I confess I don't have anything really to add to that. I mean, I think it is a really good question why federally funded research should generate patents that are owned privately. I think it's a complicated issue, and I can't really offer any further insight beyond what Maury said. I think she raises very good points. You know, coming back to what I said earlier, I mean, developing drugs and treatments cost a ridiculous amount of money, something that universities can invest in and publicly we wouldn't want to because it's just too much of a risk, I would say, for taxpayer money. So that should exist in the private domain. But how to bridge that with basic discoveries that might enable those private ventures that might happen in the university setting from federally funded research, I think that's a big question, and I don't have any answers for it, actually.
Well, Marcia Donofsky, I know you think about these questions and how this should be regulated or how we might want to change the way things have been arranged, which is not how it's always been. So I'm interested how you'd respond to Maury.
I agree with Sam. It's a really complicated question that calls into a public debate the way the entire healthcare system is operated, as well as the way that basic scientific research is operated. But I think what we can say in a brief moment now is just that we need to bring these issues to the public, and we need to have debate, democratic deliberation about them. And I think we have to really, you know, it's not the job of the scientists in the lab to figure this out by themselves. But, you know, I think we have to really assess what's going on. So, for example, Sam mentioned correctly that Novartis, the drug company, is experimenting with novel pricing schemes, and they've said that their treatment for leukemia, based on this cancer immunotherapy approach, if you don't respond, then you don't pay. Well, that's true if you don't respond within a month. But what happens with a lot of the people who are, well, it's not a lot because it's a very small number who have taken this treatment so far, and we should also say it's a very physically challenging treatment that leads to very dangerous side effects in some patients. But the pricing is only a month out, and a number of the people in the subjects in these clinical trials have relapsed 2-3 months out. So, you know, then you're stuck with this $500,000 bill. I mean, another proposal from the drug companies has been, well, let's have these very expensive treatments financed the way we take out a mortgage on our house. Well, so that means that if you know you want to live and try to live by taking this particular treatment, which may or may not work for a month, 6 months, a year, or two, then you're going to be saddled with this $500,000 debt for the rest of your life. So the proposals that the drug companies are coming up with do not seem adequate to the challenge, in my opinion.
So, I mean, there's a lot of news coming out about this. People are hearing about new therapies. They're hearing about this battle over patents that's happened. And then, you know, there's some things coming up from specific drug companies about how they'd like to handle these things. But where, Marcy, where is that public discussion happening? I know that these treatments are treated as drugs. So the FDA is the federal regulator of this stuff. But where is that conversation? If people are concerned, if they want to say, hey, let's talk about how we direct this, how we make sure it actually benefits the public, where would they make their voice heard? Where is that conversation happening?
Well, a little bit in terms of the regulatory agencies. They do have public hearings, but it's very difficult to have a say. You get a minute or two. One of the things that we do at the Center for Genetics and Society is try to create venues, webinars, newsletters, and that kind of thing, because we think that these are political issues in the same way that issues of taxation, health care, housing, all those things need really serious public participation. And that doesn't happen by itself. You know, you have to really work at organizing that, and you have to really work at this in particular because we have to bridge the scientific conversation and the social justice conversation, and it does take work, but it's, I think, work that we have to do as a society, or we're going to find ourselves waking up in a world of greater inequality and greater injustice.
Sam Sternberg, my sense is that you and Jennifer Doudna and other people that you work with are interested in trying to bridge that scientific conversation and the social conversation about this. Where do you see that happening? How are you thinking about participating in that? I mean, obviously, you're here today. That's part of it, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, I try to get out and give as many talks to non-scientists as I can, and actually, in the last year or two, I've given more talks to non-scientists than I have at kind of the typical conferences that I spend most of my grad school going to. You know, it's been a pleasure being on the radio with Marcy a couple times now, and I have to give Jennifer a lot of credit for being one of the leading voices a couple years ago and really helping spur the first international summit on human gene editing, where Marcy was also a speaker. And I think as much as it might feel uncomfortable to go on the radio and talk about things that are really outside of my wheelhouse, as Marcy pointed out, I think, you know, scientists can't do it alone. Folks from her perspective can't do it alone. I think we need to meet somewhere in the middle and get everyone talking from their own perspective and really try to find common ground where we can have that discussion. So I think, you know, the more that people can come together in that kind of dialogue, the better.
I want to, before Marcy, did you want to jump in there?
Well, yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I would just, you know, add that these kind of media programs are really important, but also really looking at the questions from the different points of view of different parts of civil society. So let's really look at this from the point of view of reproductive rights and justice, from the point of view of environmental justice and disability rights and justice and racial justice. And so that's one of the things that, you know, we've been trying to do. And there's a lot of interest in it, but, you know, everybody in these sectors has very full plates, especially right now with the current administration. So we're bringing a whole new issue. And I think people are beginning to understand just how important it is.
Well, before we go, I'm going to bring up one other issue that came in from a listener named G.S. in San Leandro, who writes a couple of different things, but I'll read one of them. Are we not setting ourselves up for the abuse of this powerful new gene editing technology? Surely we all want to support those who would carry on with noble intent, but what about those with evil intent? I'm concerned about the possible weaponization of organisms for purposes of war. And I think with any new technology, people really wonder, how might they be used for good or evil? Quick thoughts from you before we go. Marcy Darnofsky.
Yeah, that's such an important question. And, you know, the Pentagon through DARPA has been interested and has supported some of the research and public discussions on related issues. So there, you know, we really have to keep an eye on that as well. And from my vantage point, I've been really it's sobering that there are not civil society organizations or responsible science organizations that are focusing really on those military applications. So, yeah, we have our hands full focusing on the possible abuses by scientists who are trying to evade the rules that we do have around, for example, inheritable genetic modification. It's a big challenge.
Sam Sternberg, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would just comment, you know, I think the weaponization question brings up something that we haven't really touched on in this hour, which is the non-human uses of CRISPR. I think, you know, there's a field called gene drives where CRISPR's begun to be explored as a way of spreading traits into wild populations. And that's a big area of concern now for the reasons that listener brought up. I think it is reassuring that the National Academies of Science and Medicine have been looking at this. They've issued a report on this gene drive technology. And I guess one lasting thought I would say, you know, most breakthrough technologies can be used for good and for bad. I think it's absolutely something we need to be vigilant about and be paying attention to, but it also shouldn't be something that causes, you know, unnecessary alarm and cause us to be afraid to move forward. I think we need to just be extremely responsible and be aware of the risks, but also be optimistic about the potentials.
Sounds to me like we should do a follow-up program talking about those non-human questions. It's really interesting, and obviously we barely got to get there. Huge subject. I want to thank both of you so much. Dr. Sam Sternberg is a protein RNA biochemist and CRISPR expert, co-author along with Jennifer Doudna of A Crack in Creation. And also with us for the hour has been Dr. Marcy Darnofsky, Executive Director of the Center for Genetics and Society. Dr. Darnofsky, Dr. Sternberg, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us. We're going to leave it there. Thanks to everyone who called and emailed. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit our website, yourcallradio.org. Malihei Razazan was the producer of today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. And Ashley Ann Krigbaum was on the phones. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks again for listening. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will be back tomorrow. This is Your Call.